Today, in a world in which news flashes around the globe in an instant, time lags are inconceivable. In the mid-19th century, communication between the United States and Europe, which was the center of world affairs back then, was only as quick as the fastest ship could cross the Atlantic, making the United States isolated and vulnerable. But in 1866, the old and new worlds were united by the successful laying of a cable across the Atlantic. My guest is John Steele Gordon, who has written many books chronicling the growth of America, The Scarlet Woman of Wall Street, A History of Wall Street in the 1860s, Hamilton's Blessing, The Extraordinary Life and Times of Our National Debt, The Great Game, The Emergence of Wall Street as a World Power, 1653 to 2000, and A Thread Across the Ocean, The Heroic Story of the Transatlantic Cable. Now, I read A Thread a few years ago, and it seems I'm going through a phase of understanding the historical context of our world today. And John Steele Gordon's book chronicles this extraordinary achievement that changed our world forever. And I have him on the show with me right now. Welcome, John.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
John, it's a great book, and I've now just recently reread it. And again, it holds up really quite well. What was the state of communications between the old world and the new?
Well, they have been improving throughout the 19th century. In 1800, the average time going from America to England was about 6 weeks, and going the other way was about 8 weeks. But if the weather was really lousy, it could be 3 months. By the middle of the 19th century, they had steamships, and the time frame was going down and down and down. By the 1860s, it was about 10 days for the fastest ship.
So all of the news that was happening in Europe, any wars or volcanoes like Krakatoa and so on, nobody really knew about that for quite a long period of time, correct?
Yes, and it could be 2 weeks before you heard some big news that happened in Europe.
You know, you wrote in your book that when people came to the United States, they basically had to stay here. There was really no going back, except for a few business people and elites. Traveling back and forth between the old and new world was literally impossible. So what was the kind of person, and this is rhetorical, I have to ask myself, what was the kind of person that would make that one-way trip, knowing not what faced them in the new world at this early period of time in our country's history, but the fact that this was basically it, almost all ties to the old world were cut. And there was this tremendous desire now to try to bring the two worlds together. Now, a lot of things were happening both in England and in the United States in the early 1800s. New England was going through a tremendous upsurge in manufacturing in the Industrial Revolution. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Industrial Revolution began in England in the middle of the 18th century. Historians are forever arguing about exactly when. It's not very important, which is why they argue about it. In the United States, the Industrial Revolution began very early in the 19th century with cotton mills in New England, where they had quickly flowing rivers that could power it. And that became a very big industry, and that it was growing quickly in the United States, but England was still by far the industrial powerhouse of the world.
Mm-hmm. And they were expanding their own empire to faraway, lands and climes and so on, right? So England reached how far?
England reached around the world. I mean, it was literally true that the sun never sets on the British Empire. It was the biggest empire in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm. Also, we were starting to create electricity through the use of steam and other technologies, which started to improve manufacturing of cotton and other things as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, the steam engine was what really powered the Industrial Revolution, because it was the first new form of work doing energy since the windmill, which was invented in the 7th century AD. Mm. Here was, you turn a low value energy, heat, into something that can move things. And it transformed the world and rapidly developed a new kinds of steam. I mean, the Watt steam engine was obsolescent by early 19th century. So they had a new kind of steam engine called a puffer engine, because it exhausted the steam in both the upstroke and the downstroke. Mm-hmm. So it made a puff, 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 puff noise, and that was powerful enough to move railroads. And that meant that you could move freight overland cheaply and quickly.
Right.
And that was a big revolution.
It was also the harnessing of electricity at that point in time. I mean, we all know about Benjamin Franklin and the kite experiment with the key. And, you know, electricity was discovered early on. It was not understood early on. But this idea that you could actually move electricity through a cable was important, or through a wire was important. Tell us about that.
Well, indeed, at that time, electricity was not well understood, although we understood much better by the 1840s than we had in Franklin's day.
Yeah.
But we knew that, you know, it could be transmitted long distances down a wire, and the trick was to find a way to use that as a signal. And it was Samuel Morse who, you know, there were lots of people, they were one in England and stuff, but Morse came up with the Morse code, which was a marvelously simple way to transmit information through a wire. And, you know, once you learn Morse code, if you're good at it, you can interpret it by ear. And so good, you know, trained telegraphers would simply, they listen to the Morse code and just write it down. And so this could move information, and it started 1844 from the Capitol building in Washington. He telegraphed to his partner up in Baltimore, "What hath God wrought?" And it then took over by the 1850s. Telegraph lines were reaching all the way down to New Orleans and up into Canada and what have you, and of course also in England and Europe.
So these were overland wires in which the electricity traveled pretty easily, very fast. And there was a lot of talk about trying to lay some underground or underwater cable in order to bridge straits and, you know, small seas and other things. And that was actually happening on the European continent by this point, right?
Yes. Well, they wanted to lay a cable under the English Channel. So that's only about 25 miles or even less than that. And actually, the first time they did it, a French fisherman accidentally caught it in his net and pulled it up and didn't have any idea what it was. So he cut a piece out to take home and show people. And that was the end of that cable. But pretty soon it was working. And then it was Cyrus Field who, he said, you know, boy, that's a great idea. Why don't we lay a cable across the Atlantic Ocean? And he said later that if he had known anything about it, he would never have started. Because it was sort of like, you know, somebody reading about Sputnik in 1957 and saying, hey, let's send a manned expedition to Mars. I mean, it was just an order of magnitude more complex and probably two orders of magnitude more expensive.
Cyrus Field is the main protagonist in the story. Who was he?
Cyrus Field came from a remarkable New England family. One of his brothers, Stephen Field, sat on the U.S. Supreme Court. Another was David Dudley Field, who was probably the greatest lawyer of the 19th century and wrote the Field Code of Civil Procedure, which is now used around the whole English-speaking world.
Right.
And so Cyrus Field went into business, and he became a paper manufacturer and made a fortune. And, you know, he was one of those people who always had to be doing something new. Once the paper company was up and running and throwing off money, just running it was boring.
Yeah.
And so he went to South America with a great artist. Sorry, I just can't think of his name off the top of my head. And then he read about the cable and he said, let's do that. And he started, and he was, you know, once he got the bit in his teeth, he just wouldn't stop until he succeeded. Frederick Church is the artist.
Yeah. There's a quote in your book that he had the desire to own the means of instant communication, which I thought sounds like a very modern phrase, this idea of instant communication. He wanted to be the first, and, you know, he obviously, there were many drivers, but not the least of which was to continue to build his fortune. So he basically put together a consortium of pretty well-known people at the time. I know Samuel Morse was involved on his board or in this initial group. Peter Cooper, who formed the Cooper Union, if you know of New York, you'll know the Cooper Union. It's actually where Lincoln spoke and basically became noticed by the world after the Cooper Union speech. Who else was involved in this consortium that we may or may not be familiar with?
There were a bunch of New York businessmen, most of whose names are now pretty much forgotten. There was the head of the Citibank. There was the head of one of the gas companies that was supplying, you know, gas for lighting. People like that, their names are now no longer, you know, in current use. But they were a group of the richest men in New York, which meant they were the richest men in the country.
So what were the difficulties? I mean, there were numerous attempts. Let's talk about the first attempt. Seemed very naive looking back at this thing. What was the cable made up of? How did they insulate the cable? I mean, there's all these considerations. And really, how did they roll the cable out through all of this 2,500 miles they were trying to cover?
Well, the first cable was very badly designed because they didn't know how to design it. It was a steep learning curve to climb here. It was heavy in terms of its volume. And what it was a strands of copper wound around each other. And then insulation was, then there was iron used to, you know, armor the cable. And then it was insulated with a stuff called gutta percha, which came from a tree in Asia. Basically, it's a kind of plastic. Mm-hmm. And it was used for lots of things. It would harden. And they used it to make walking sticks. And they also discovered that it made much better golf balls. And so, and it was, you know, it was the first plastic. It came from a tree. It wasn't, you know, created chemically, but still it was functionally a plastic.
The quality of the ships back then also were a problem as well, right?
Well, they simply weren't big enough. There was no ship in the world that could carry 2,500 miles of cable. And so the British used one of their warships, and we used the Niagara, which was one of America's biggest and best warships. And the original theory was that the British would start in Ireland, and we would start in Newfoundland, and we'd meet in the Atlantic and splice the two together.
The first attempt, there was a lot of celebrating, a lot of newspaper accolades, but it was an utter failure, right?
Yes, yeah, so they got about 400 miles and dropped the cable, and they couldn't find it again, and that was the end of that. Yeah.
Cable broke, 400 miles of cable irretrievably lost.
Yeah. And so they did it the next year.
Yeah, okay.
They tried again the next year, and this time they decided to, you know, start in Ireland and go to the mid-Atlantic, and then they would meet up, splice the cable there, then continue to Newfoundland. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they ran into a horrendous storm, and both ships barely survived.
Right.
And so they had to abandon them. The next year, in 1858, they actually succeeded in getting the cable across to Newfoundland. And Newfoundland had already been connected by telegraph from Nova Scotia across what's known as the Cabot Strait at the entrance to the St. Lawrence River. And so once they got to Newfoundland, then they were connected to the American telegraph network, and everything was supposed to be fine. And they had a huge celebration, had a big parade up Broadway. They set off fireworks from New York City Hall, burnt the cupola on the top of City Hall, and they almost lost the whole building. And Queen Victoria sent a message to President Buchanan. It was 99 words, and it took 16 hours to transmit.
Which they didn't tell anybody. They didn't tell anybody that they were having problems transmitting. They just said it's working, and the Queen Victoria message actually got across. But actually, what happened then?
Well, what happened was they kept having to repeat it. I mean, basically, the guy at the other end kept saying, "What?" You know, retransmit.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was just barely detectable. And then after about 10 days, the cable just stopped. You know, it was dead as a doornail.
All this celebration, all of this, the newspaper accolades, and then it stopped. And then actually everything just turned against the whole plan. There were claims of fraud. Cyrus Field was scorned. And yet he said, "We'll do it once again."
One thing is very important. This is 1858. This is in 1857. There had been the Great Indian Mutiny had broken out, the greatest crisis of British India in the 19th century. But by 1858, it was winding down, and a regiment that was stationed in Canada had been ordered to India. And during that 10-day time frame, when the cable was still working, Britain was able to send a message to Canada saying, "Don't send that regiment. We don't need it." Mm. And thereby saving about £300,000, which is a lot of money in the mid-19th century. So Britain realized the extreme utility of undersea cables because they had a worldwide empire to run. You know, we needed it just because we'd like to get the latest news from Europe more quickly, but Britain needed it to run their empire. And so they were willing to continue. And what they did actually was they sat down and figured out what had gone wrong. What have they done wrong? So they won't make the same mistake again. This is how we've done this ever since. Just like when an airplane crashes, we go to a great deal of trouble to figure out exactly why that plane crashed and how can we stop another such accident happening again. That's what they did this time. And it greatly improved. They also got help from a man named William Thompson, who was a professor of physics in Scotland, and he later became Lord Kelvin. The Kelvin scale of temperature is named for him.
Yep.
He was one of the greatest physicists of the 19th century, and he helped design a new cable that was, it was fatter around, but it was lighter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it came closer to floating than the old one had, which was very important, made it less likely to break.
This is a great story. Unfortunately, we're out of time. The final part of this story is that there was substantial success in 1866, and money transactions were now being equalized between London and New York, and there were two worlds that were starting to come together. My guest is John Steele Gordon. The book is A Thread Across the Ocean, The Heroic Story of the Transatlantic Cable. And if you have a question about what we just discussed, ask us. Go to stevepomerantz.com. Ask us anything you'd like at stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update where we will send you the weekly commentaries and interviews straight to your inbox. John Gordon, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.